Like so many children of mixed marriages, the author Heidi Durrow has often felt like she's had to straddle two worlds. She's the daughter of a black serviceman and a white Danish mother. Her own personal search for identity inspired her debut novel. It's called The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. The story revolves around a girl who moves across country to live with her grandmother after surviving a family tragedy. That preteen, Rachel, is also the daughter of a black GI and a white Danish mother. And as the story unfolds, you discover just how unfathomable her family tragedy was. Her mother, brother, and baby sister all died after leaping off a Chicago apartment building, a jaw-dropping turn of events that was actually based on a real story. And Heidi Durrow joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
What was that event that inspired the tragedy in the book, the mother leaping off a building with her small children?
It was a real newspaper story that I read about 15 years ago. A mother went to the top of a building, and the only survivor of this fall was this girl. I remember reading that and just being haunted by not the questions that the other people were asking about why this happened and how could we live in a world where this would happen, but I wondered what would her survival look like?
And what the girl's survival would look like.
Yes, yes. I wanted to give her a future. I was hoping her life wouldn't be defined by a tragedy. And I really wanted to give her a voice to see how she might grow up.
How difficult was it as a writer to write about a little girl named Rachel whose life sounds a lot like yours, but also write about this mother and this cauldron of emotions that she must have been feeling that would lead her to walk her children up to the top of a building and then leap to certain death below?
It was difficult in that what I learned when I was writing the book itself is that I missed my mother when I was growing up in a way that I didn't understand until really the last year or two. My mom, like Nella, raised three kids on her own suddenly when we moved to Portland, Oregon. And she was busy working, providing for us, making sure that we would be okay. And I don't think she knew about the struggles I was having with biracial identity and living in this new place where I had to, like Rachel, identify myself in a new way that I wasn't aware of. And I, as a kid, didn't have a language for her to talk about it. And I realized as I was writing this story that maybe one of the reasons I was so haunted by this event, this newspaper story of a mother who goes to the top of the building and thinks this is the best way, is just that I'm glad my mom didn't think those things. I'm glad that she actually gave us a chance to go through all the struggles that we did.
Nella is the mother. I'm wondering, is that a nod to Nella Larsen, the Harlem Renaissance writer?
It is. She's hugely important for me, and she's half black and half Danish, and she's my muse in many ways. I wish that she could hear this story now and see if she finds herself in my story all these many years later when she was writing about this back in the 1920s and early 30s.
She's the author of the books Quicksand and Passing.
Yeah. In college, I was really enamored with the African-American women writers that I was reading. And I read The Bluest Eye, and I thought, oh my goodness, Toni Morrison gets me. She understands me because of Pecola Breedlove. And I don't think it was until much later, I'd say in my late 20s, that I read it again, and I realized, oh my God, Pecola Breedlove isn't me. You know, she was the little black girl who desperately wanted blue eyes, and that's what led to all sorts of devastation for her. And I'm the little brown girl who has blue eyes and is trying to make sense of the world.
Heidi, in the book, Rachel often feels like she has to choose, you know, either move toward one culture or hold on to her Danishness. Why does she have to choose? Why do children of mixed-race marriages have to make that kind of choice? Why can't they embrace both cultures?
Well, I think they can if they're not faced with this question, what are you? The satisfactory answer usually isn't, I'm black and white. Other people want mixed-race kids to choose who they are. you know, I started this book in 1997. It's taken that long to write it and to get it published. And the language has changed, definitely, about biracial identity. Obviously, when President Obama began his candidacy and we started to talk about biracial, it suddenly didn't sound like a scientific term. Still, though, now, I think people are uneasy with that. And I think we can see that in the fact that once there was the inauguration, President Obama became our first African-American president, which I believe he is. But we stopped talking about biracial again. I think it's a little unsettling for people for just trying to understand what does it mean to be both black and white.
Heidi, as you well know, there's a long line of stories, books, movies, songs, folklore about the tragic mulatto trope. Why does this continue? And do you in any way feel like you were pulled into that undertow?
I hope I wasn't. I hope that people can read this book as a break from that tradition. I think that tragedies generally end with a tragedy and there's nothing learned. And my book begins with the tragedy. And at the end, I hope that people have learned something, that there's a note of triumph in that. I wanted, especially in the story, to say, yes, something really bad has happened to this girl. Yes, it's really difficult for her to deal with her mixed race background in the world as it exists, but the tragedy is outside of her. It's not something that's part of her character. I think that's the thing that's been frustrating about other stories about the tragic mulatto, that somehow it was an inherent difficulty within the character. For Rachel, it's definitely not true that the difficulties come from without and that she has this center, this core, this heart that really is, she's still able to be whole ultimately and I think ultimately triumphant.
One last quick question for you. Are you okay with the term biracial or is there something else that you would like to hear as a label or a description applied to you?
I like biracial. I say I'm mixed. I say I'm half African-American and half Danish. If I have to say that I'm just black or I'm just white, then I'm not telling the whole story of myself or my experience. And I'd really like to be whole in my conversations with others. The thing I like to say these days is I'm a story. I think that would be the very best label of all, definitely.
Heidi Duro, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Heidi Duro is the author of The Girl Who Fell from the Sky.
Well, as you can see, we're still having tea. And it's all because I was at my special time waiting for your return. You're terribly late, you know. Naughty. Why a raven is like a writing desk.
Lewis Carroll's beloved tale, Alice in Wonderland, has been reincarnated once again as a movie. This time, Tim Burton puts his unique cinematic spin on the Mad Hatter, the White Rabbit, the Red Queen, and Alice's adventures. There is also a new historical novel that tells the story of the young girl who inspired Carroll, the pen name of the Reverend Charles Dodgson. In the late 1860s, Dodgson was a budding photographer and a professor of mathematics at Oxford University, where Little's father was dean. When Alice was 7, Dodgson took her picture, and that photograph was the inspiration for Alice, I Have Been, the new book by Melanie Benjamin. She joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Describe the photograph.
It is of a very young girl, like many of Carroll's or Dodgson's photographs were. She's wearing rags, but they are very artfully arranged so that bits of skin are showing. What fascinated me the most is the expression in this very little girl's face. The expression was so, I thought, worldly and frank and adult and, dare I say, womanly.
Sultry would be
yes,
a way to describe it, even though she's 7 years old.
That's the thing. It's a startling picture.
Right. In the novel, I mean, you have members of her family sort of warning her, or they just don't trust Charles Dodgson very much. But Alice Little loves him. You know, she seems to be way beyond her years in the way that she feels for him. What happened that ended their relationship?
We don't know, and that was one of my greatest gifts as a novelist. When I depict Alice having this crush on him, these feelings for him, she's 11 in the book, and I don't think that that is as unusual a thing as we might think. I can remember when I was 11 and I had quite a crush on my fifth grade teacher who, you know, I think we have feelings, and particularly in the Victorian times, a girl could be married legally at the age of 12. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's that unusual that she had these feelings for this man who seemed to pick her out of her family and hold her as something special in her life. And then as far as what ended the relationship, when he was 31 and she was 11, there is this abrupt break in the relations. It resulted in her mother burning all the correspondence between the two of them, and in his relations later on deleted the portions of his diary that dealt with this time. For 150 years, historians have been trying to figure out what happened. Every few years, someone else comes up with a new concept or a new theory or a new idea. Alice and her family never, ever spoke of this. There were rumors. There were rumors around Oxford. But what I take away from this is that 150 years later, we still so very much want to know what happened.
You start the book when Alice is an older woman. I mean, she's in her 80s. You have her wanting to write to her sister, who was very suspicious of the relationship between Alice and Dodgson. What was the letter that you found that you begin the book with?
The one that I begin the book with?
Yeah.
Is just, I've never found the entire letter, but I have found this bit of it, and it begins, "But oh my dear, I am tired of being Alice in Wonderland." Does it sound ungrateful? It is. Only I do get tired. And I just thought that was an amazing way to begin this story, because she was Alice in Wonderland to someone in a different way all through her life.
Now, the manuscript was given to her, and he had written Alice in Wonderland just for her.
He wrote the story down for Alice. It took him a couple of years. He told it to her. It was 1862, and she was 10 when he told her the story, and it was not until November of 1863, I think it was, that he actually sent it to her, what he had promised that he would write down for her. He illustrated it for her. And even at the end, even though the Alice is 10 in the book, he pasted a photograph of her at age 7 at the end of it, which I find fascinating.
Well, the thing is, I don't think Dodgson wanted her to grow up. He wanted to, you know, forever keep her in the amber of being, you know, between 7 and 10 years old. What do you want us to take away?
There is no stereotypical victim predator here. I think that has kind of become one of the conventional ways to look at their relationship. And I really believe that the truth is more complex than that. I think that he was a very lonely man and she was a very lonely little girl. And I think the tragedy is that they came together at the wrong time. And perhaps if it had been 10 to 15 years later, things might have been different for them. But this relationship, however tragic it was, and it was truly tragic, it gave the world Wonderland, after all. So that there's both beauty and tragedy in this relationship between two very lonely people.
Melanie Benjamin is the author of the historical novel Alice, I Have Been, published by Random House. Melanie Benjamin joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've flown recently, given the bad weather across the country, chances are you've spent some time twiddling your thumbs in an airport lounge. Well, we can't do anything about the weather or the delays, but we can do something about the boredom. Here's author Susan Jane Gilman with some recommended airport reading.
I don't have a Kindle, but I do have my pride and pretension. When I travel, I want something delicious and escapist to read that won't insult my intelligence or embarrass me in airports. Thankfully, some smart breezy paperbacks have recently been published that are great alternatives to classic airplane reading. and they have nothing to do with vampires. Elaine Dundy's novel, The Old Man and Me, is far more literary than chick lit, but just as much fun. This reissue of her 1962 classic absolutely crackles with deviousness and wit. It's the story of Honey Flood, a shameless young American gold digger who arrives in England determined to ensnare an older aristocrat. Honey is a terrific female anti-hero, part Holly-go-lightly, part Daisy Miller, but badder, bolder. Want a light, modern, on the road? Try The Flying Troutmans by Miriam Taves, a poignant American road trip novel with a twist. It's Canadian. Two highly creative, exasperating teenagers have been abandoned by their mother. Their beleaguered young aunt flies in from Paris to rescue them. The three set out on a desperate mission across the continent. Their story echoes the movie Little Miss Sunshine in that it's a frothy mix of absurdity and family drama in a beat-up minivan. It's easy reading and entertaining. Prefer real adventure? In 1977, Daniel Everett, a Christian missionary, plunged into the Amazonian jungle with his wife and children. Their goal? To enlighten one of the most remote tribes on the planet. This tribe, Everett discovered, exists entirely in the present, without words for colors, numbers, or the passage of time. They have no concept of war or personal property. So, guess what? They ended up enlightening Everett instead. He spent decades with them, and his nonfiction account, Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, is riveting. And it's serious escapism. This book boldly takes you where almost no man has gone before. Yep, that's a Star Trek reference. If sci-fi is your passion, you may be a nerd or just read like one. Either way, there's much to love in Benjamin Nugent's insightful book, American Nerd, The Story of My People. Its history of the nerd does a brilliant job of explaining geekdom and anti-intellectualism in America. There are keen observations about jocks, racism, autism, and, of course, Dungeons and Dragons. While a few sections go off on distinctly nerdy tangents, it's an original, sometimes very funny read. If you traditionally buy self-help books, pick up How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read by Pierre Bayard. Just one read will make you seem infinitely more literate. Bayard's work is cleverer than its title suggests. It's chock full of perceptions, philosophy, and humor. If none of these appeal, here's one last recommendation for hardcore grumps. On the Genealogy of Morals by Friedrich Nietzsche. Okay, it ain't new, and it certainly ain't escapist, but it is alienating. Nothing like brandishing a 19th-century German depressive on an airplane to repel all those cheery chit-chat travelers seated beside you. Bah, humbug. And it, too, is available in paperback.
Susan Jane Gilliman is the author of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven.
Lucille Clifton, a pioneering American poet, passed away on February 13th. We want to mark her passing and the work she leaves behind, so NPR's David Gura wrote this appreciation.
When Lucille Clifton was growing up on Lake Erie in the 1940s, she never thought she'd be a poet, as she told NPR in 1993.
The only poets I ever saw were the portraits that hung on the walls in elementary school in Buffalo, New York, old dead white men with beards from New England.
Clifton didn't look like Longfellow or Whittier or Whitman. She was a woman, an African-American, a wife and a mother to six children. Her family was incredibly important to her and to her writing. This is a 1995 recording of Clifton reading a poem about her father, Sam.
If he could have kept the sky in his dark hand, he would have pulled it down and held it. It would have called him Lord, as did the skinny women in Virginia. If he could have gone to school, he would have learned to write his story and not live it. If he could have done better, he would have. Oh, stars and stripes forever, what did you do to my father?
Lucille Clifton cared deeply about history, about her own personal history, and about the history of the United States. In her poems, she re-examined American history. She tackled tough subjects, injustice, racism, sexism, the apocalyptic. Still, Clifton could have, and often did have, a remarkably light touch, a penchant for humor. Poet Elizabeth Alexander teaches at Yale.
She said, "With my poetry, I hope to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable."
In print, Lucille Clifton's poems look distinctive, with limited punctuation and few capital letters.
There's a kind of quietude in the lowercase, but also a boldness of direct speech.
Kevin Young is a poet and a professor at Emory University.
She's just talking to you, but she's also sort of singing at the same time.
"Hey, music and me, only white. Hair a flutter of fall leaves, circling my perfect line of a nose, no lips, no behind. Hey, white me. And I'm wearing white history. But there's no future in those clothes. So I take them off, and I wake up dancing."
A recording of Clifton reading at the Guggenheim Museum in 1983 from poets.org. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove says Clifton could distill vital moments into moving, powerful poems. She was concise.
"It is so much more difficult to write simply than it is to write in a complex manner. What she did to pare it down to the essential and still have it sing, that is hard."
Her ability to do that led to Pulitzer Prize nominations and a National Book Award. In 2007, Clifton received the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, one of the highest honors in American letters. She paved the way for poets like Dove, Kevin Young, and Elizabeth Alexander.
She inspired not just respect and admiration, but very, very, very deep love.
David Gura, NPR News.